Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop, Cancer and the Workplace. This is really a very important topic that we're offering today, one that many of you have asked us to offer in the past, and it's one that we'd like to offer at least once or twice a year. It's just so important. Today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration, as well as your interest in the topic, that we have over 918 participants on the program. So this is a very large call, and you come from all over the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, Malaysia, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And today's program was made possible by a grant from Amgen. I really want to thank them for their support of this really important program today. And I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you were sent from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's information about our, all of our speakers and the topics that they'll be addressing. There also is information about all of our collaborating organizations as resources for each of you. And there also is information about how you can let us know what you think about the program. This is an evaluation form. And I would ask you to take a moment and complete that evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the programs and the topics that you'd like us to offer? We very much appreciate taking a few minutes at the end of the day of the program today and completing that very brief evaluation form and letting us know what you'd like us to do. We're planning many programs going forward, and your feedback really helps to keep the programs relevant to you, to what you really would like us to do. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. Our first speaker is Dr. Stuart Fleischman. And Dr. Fleischman is Founding Director, Cancer Support Services, Continuum Cancer Centers of New York, Accreditation Surveyor, American College of Surgeons, Commission on Cancer. And Dr. Fleischman is going to address advances in cancer treatments and side effect management, managing your cancer treatments while working, talking with your healthcare team about your work and how important it is to you, and understanding the meaning of work for people living with cancer. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Fleischman.
Thank you, Carolyn, for inviting me to speak today, and I hope this is very helpful to everybody. This is usually a very big concern for people who are either starting treatment, anticipating treatment, or in the middle of treatment, because for many of us, work is such an integral part of who we are and what we do that people are usually very concerned that they're not able to work all the way through their course of treatment. And in my experience over about the last 30 years, this has changed quite a bit for the better. It used to be, and I hate to say way back when, but 30 years ago in the cancer world really does seem like way back when, just about all of treatment was on an inpatient basis. And people who were working often had to take long periods of time off. Some of that was compensated. Some people did have disability insurance, but a lot of people did not. And there were huge gaps in the time that people had to take off from work. But now, since most of treatment is ambulatory, which means you live at home, you go in for your treatments, you may be there for a few minutes or a few hours a day or practically all week, it seems, the burden of work actually is off the hospital staff and back onto our patients and our families. But it really has changed, the focus quite a bit. And the ability to say, I'm going to take off from work through this really depends upon a number of things, and often that is if you have disability insurance, if it's long-term disability, which means there often is a period of time that you don't get any sort of salary income for the first few weeks or months, and then it goes on for a period of time, or short-term disability, where you're able to get some reimbursement of your salary for the first few weeks or months, but then it doesn't continue very long. And some people have that as part of their federal benefits but short-term disability is a lot more variable. So whether you can take off or can't take off, it's important to remember that because of the changes in treatments, much more of cancer treatment these days is based upon oral medications, more than ever before, and the trend will continue and actually increase. Some people come to the hospital for daily or weekly infusions of chemotherapy. Some people will come in even once a month. Some people will come in for radiation therapy 5 days a week for a few weeks at a time. Some people will come in for an isolated radiation treatment every few days. It really depends upon the type of cancer you have and the best treatment that's recommended to you. So the schedules are really very, very different. And some workplaces have been able to adjust to that and others have not. If we look at the things that people still are concerned about through their treatment, fatigue is often one of the most top-endorsed symptoms that people talk about when asked. Fatigue is not that kind of mild tiredness that we all get, but a severe, often overwhelming tiredness that can be due to a number of things, but we've learned a lot about this type of fatigue over the years. We do know that for most people it's temporary. We do know that it changes over treatment. It's not the same throughout treatment. And we do know that through good exercise, good rest, good sleep, sleep's very important, good nutrition, and sometimes using medications that actually boost the red count, we can actually minimize or even forestall much of the anemia that people used to experience in the past. So fatigue is high up. Worry, we all worry and that about what's going to happen. Will the treatment work? Will the cancer come back? That often takes up a good deal of our time and our brain power, but many people say that work is a blessing because it actually diverts their attention from some of the worry for part of the day. And that, again, that varies from person to person. Nausea and vomiting used to be a very big issue. It still happens, but much less so. Some of the big advances in cancer treatment are new, improved nausea medicines that are much more effective than 20, 30 years ago, are used in combinations that we never did before. And nausea and vomiting is really not the kind of thing that keeps people out of work. The skin reactions are new to a lot of the oral treatments and some of the newer chemotherapies, and that's something that needs to be addressed because they can be visible. It's not just like a rash, but it can be quite severe, and they need to be managed with creams and sometimes cortisone or steroid medicines throughout the day, as well as antibiotics. That can be done if you go to work. It's a little tricky to do sometimes, but it certainly can be done. And despite the fact that we also have colony-stimulating factors to increase our white blood cell counts, to increase our resistance and help fight infection, we really still need to make sure to avoid lots of crowds. So we often advise people to get to work early, earlier than expected, so that if the elevator is full, if you work in an elevator building, that you can wait for an empty elevator instead of getting in an elevator where everybody's coughing and sneezing. If you're commuting to work in public transportation, buses, trains, subways, to make sure to be able to try to travel at times of the day that aren't so crowded, again, so people aren't sneezing and coughing on you, because many of the respiratory infections can be passed that way. But despite the fact of antibiotics and colony-stimulating factors, we really do ask that people try to avoid crowds still to these days. So at the workplace, once you're there, having a flexible schedule, sometimes even working at times of the day, if your workplace can accommodate you when it's not so crowded, that may be a possible thing to do. Lots of hand washing. Hard to do if you're in a commuter bus, but obviously at work, hand washing can be done in the bathroom using the wipes that you keep on your desk or in your cubicle. Really keeping clean and keeping surfaces clean, telephones, computer screens, doorknobs, things like that. It may seem a little bit excessive, but that's where lots of things can hide and can actually affect us if our resistance is low from chemotherapy or radiation therapy. This, as I mentioned before, skin reactions will not only affect how you feel, but actually how you look. Many people will try to wear long-sleeve clothing or pants if possible, so they don't have to have the skin rash actually show. And vigilance of that, time off during the day to cream up, and is essential to maintaining that when you have to work with a skin reaction. What's important to realize is that sometimes how you look and how you feel are very different, and many people who aren't in a visible place when they're at work, if they don't look their best, it's okay. Some people are in very visible places, and it really depends upon the kind of work you do and negotiating with your employer. We're going to talk about disclosure a little later, but deciding who to tell, who not to tell is also an issue for people. But if you can disclose it, and if you do discuss the cancer and your treatment and what it entails and the kinds of things that can be expected, you may actually be able to get some accommodation at work. Describing your workplace, though, to your cancer treatment team is vital because they're the ones that can really advise you on the kinds of things that you can expect over the course of a number of days or weeks or months throughout your treatment. What I've learned from patients over the years is that they sometimes will ask either the social worker in the cancer center or the nurse practitioner or the physician's assistant to actually sit for a few minutes and walk through their day and figure out the kinds of accommodations that they need to make or even ask for in their line of work and in the kinds of things that they do to better prepare themselves and then better speak at the workplace about what they need and what's important to them. Again, this is such an important thing for us because work provides so much of our meaning as to who we are if we work outside the home, that it really is a good idea to have a plan. And it's hard to think of having a plan about work when you're in the midst of treatment, but it actually can be quite helpful. We really shouldn't eliminate the people who actually work from home or work at home. That's a whole other type of work. The fatigue level can interfere with maintaining your family, getting out and doing all the things that requires to maintain a household. I believe that this call actually focused on workplace issues rather than what we do at home, which is this is work for many of us. But maybe we can handle that in some of the questions and answers that come later. So I think that's sort of a general summary of changes in cancer treatment that have occurred in the recent past as far as what to expect, minimizing nausea and vomiting, other types of side effects, how to manage that, and how to communicate both at the workplace and with your treatment team. I'll stop here.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Fleischman. Wonderful presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Deborah Wolf. Deborah Wolf is Senior Attorney, Legal Health, New York Legal Assistance Group, or NYLAG, N-Y-L-A-G. And Ms. Wolf is going to address understanding illegal protections in the workplace, and she's going to go through the various legal protections with you, as well as state and local laws. And I'm going to turn this program now over to Ms. Wolf, who is a frequent presenter on our programs, as is Dr. Fleischman, and she's going to address this very important area for you. Ms. Wolf?
Thank you, Dr. Messner. I'm happy to participate in this teleconference to discuss legal protections in the workplace. I'm going to give an overview of the laws that protect people while still working and also if they need to take a medical leave. And I'll also talk about what to do if you believe you are being discriminated against in the workplace. My focus will be on the federal laws that apply to all 50 states, but I do urge everyone listening to also become familiar with your state laws, as they often expand on the federal laws, and I'll give some examples as we go forward. I'm going to begin with a law I'm sure you've all heard of, the Americans with Disabilities Act, or is often called the ADA. This is a federal law and applies to all 50 states, to everyone who works for an employer with 15 or more employees. To be eligible for protection under the ADA, you must have a covered disability, which is defined as having an impairment as a result of your diagnosis that substantially limits a major life activity. cancer will be covered if, as a result, it limits major life activities such as walking, working, eating, or sleeping. The ADA was recently amended to give a much broader definition of what is considered a covered disability and includes an illness that has gone into remission, such as cancer. The ADA has two main benefits. The first benefit is that, as Dr. Fleischman mentioned, it requires an employer to make reasonable accommodations when requested by an employee. So basically, an employee can go to human resources or their boss if there is no HR and say, I have cancer, I can do my job, but I need you to accommodate me in this way. What's reasonable is determined on a case-by-case basis, but an employer must grant the request unless it creates an undue hardship, which is a very tough burden for the employer to establish. Some common accommodation requests include a later start in the morning due to medication side effects, a shorter work day, perhaps an extra break during the day. I recently assisted a writer set up a schedule that allowed her to work from home 3 days per week. But it's important to remember that you have to be able to do the essential functions of your job. So working from home may not always be an option for everyone. Now, an employer can't refuse an accommodation request, but they could negotiate. Perhaps say, I don't think that accommodation will work for us, but let's talk about what will work for everybody involved. So it must be what's called an interactive process. And the employee is the one that must come forward and request the accommodation. And generally, the employer is not allowed to ask if an employee is disabled or needs an accommodation. There's a few exceptions to that rule for job necessity, which includes positions that involve public safety or security, such as a firefighter. But in general, the employer is not allowed to ask questions regarding a potential disability. I always suggest that the accommodation request be made in writing with a letter of support from your doctor certifying that the accommodation is medically necessary. I also suggest this be done through human resources or someone with knowledge of employee rights and of the employer's responsibilities under the law. The second benefit of the ADA is that it prohibits discrimination against an employee because of a disability or perceived disability. This includes hiring, firing, demoting, or harassing. Also, if a person is able to do their job and has an accommodation in place or needs some time off, an employer can't take action that adversely affects their job, such as termination or demotion. The next law I want to discuss is the Family Medical Leave Act, also known as FMLA. FMLA applies to employers with 50 or more employees, and to be covered, you must have worked at your job for 12 months, and in that 12 months, worked a minimum of 1,250 hours. If qualified, an employee is entitled to 12 weeks of job-protected leave. This is unpaid leave, but can be supplemented with sick time or short-term disability if that's a benefit you're offered. During FMLA leave, employee benefits such as health insurance must continue, although employees must continue to make any contribution for health insurance or other premiums. Now, FMLA also allows for intermittent leave, which may include a few hours a week for treatment or a doctor visit. So for an example, an employee can request FMLA leave every other Thursday afternoon for treatment and perhaps the following Friday if they have side effects from their treatment, and your job will be protected for up to 12 weeks worth of time. This is an excellent benefit for somebody who's used all their sick time and are worried about losing their job or being threatened in the workplace. Now, with the Americans with Disabilities Act, you can only request benefits such as accommodations for yourself. With FMLA, you can make this request to care for yourself or a family member, such as a spouse or child. If you work for a smaller company, less than 50, and don't qualify for FMLA, time off can also be requested as a reasonable accommodation under the ADA. The request must be reasonable, and there are no clear guidelines. Everything is determined on a case-by-case basis. Now, Dr. Palos will soon be discussing disclosure in the workplace, but I want to briefly mention disclosure as it relates to discrimination. Disclosure is a personal choice, and you have the right to determine who and under what circumstances you want to disclose your health issues. And I always urge caution when disclosing. Many employers are supportive, but sometimes with disclosure it can result in discriminatory action. Often, coworkers and supervisors are not your friend. They become concerned about how your illness will affect their own job performance, such as a supervisor who needs to make sure you complete a certain project or make a quota if you work in sales. If you must disclose for an accommodation or for FMLA leave, I always suggest going to HR because they understand these laws and many supervisors do not. Any medical letter of support you provide to support your request must remain confidential and in a separate file outside of your employee file that not everybody has access to. So if your supervisor wants to see your personnel file to look at, let's say, past performance reviews, no medical information should be contained in that file. Even with these laws, discrimination does exist. Often fellow employees and even supervisors and managers don't understand what their responsibilities are under the law. So often, for example, an employee will ask their supervisor for an accommodation and the reply is, oh, we don't do that here. So if someone's working and they believe they're being discriminated against, I think at first they should try to resolve through human resources or somebody higher up if there is no human resources. HR employees are trained in these laws and they should understand your rights and try to help you resolve. If you're not able to resolve, you can file a complaint with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC, which is an agency that enforces the ADA. An EEOC complaint generally must be filed within 180 days, but it varies by state law, so I always recommend that anybody act quickly if they feel they're being discriminated against. The EEOC will investigate complaints to determine if it has merit. They might also conduct a hearing if they believe that there was discrimination. Otherwise, they'll issue what's called a right to sue letter so you can file a court case. But it's important to remember that the EEOC complaint and this right to sue letter are required before filing a lawsuit for discrimination under the ADA. And if somebody files a lawsuit without first going to the EEOC, the case generally will be dismissed. This is one area in which I suggest you also check your state laws. For example, in New York, we have a city and state human rights law that mirrors the ADA, but applies to employers with four or more employees, including reasonable accommodations. So it offers protection to a broader group of employees. If there is discrimination or if you feel you're being discriminated against, I also urge you to talk to an attorney before taking any legal steps so that you fully understand both your rights and responsibilities. I know this is a lot of information, and I encourage listeners to take the time to educate themselves about these laws that do offer protection and seek out resources such as Cancer Care to have a better understanding of their rights and responsibilities. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Deborah, for just an excellent presentation and really a very thoughtful and comprehensive review of the legal protections. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Our next speaker is Dr. Guadalupe Palos. Dr. Palos is Clinical Research Manager, Division of Medical Affairs, Department of Cancer Survivorship, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Palos is her own, really, team. When you think about it, she's both a nurse, a social worker, and a doctor of public health. So we're really fortunate to have her on the call. And she's going to talk about the issues of disclosure and communication with coworkers and supervisors and practical solutions to address workplace challenges and tips for creating a plan to continue working. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Palos.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon to all of our listeners and callers in today. We got some really good tips and advice from Dr. Fleischman and Deborah of how to take care of ourselves in the workplace. And so I'm going to address the issues that Carolyn just spoke about, but before I begin, I have a quiz for you or a question for you. What do these individuals have in common? Robin Roberts, Christina Applegate, and Michael Douglas. They're all cancer survivors, in case you haven't gotten there yet, and they have all been quite open about sharing their personal stories about their own cancer experience with the entire world. Now, you may not want to share your personal story with the whole world, but one place you may wish to share information with are the people in your workplace. However, many times we do not know how to break the news, how much to tell, or even who to tell. It becomes even more daunting when we begin to consider the many challenges that we have to face in continuing to work, because we all, like Dr. Fleischman pointed out, work is something that is very important to all of us. In the next few moments, I'm going to share a few tips about communicating and talking to your coworkers and supervisors about your diagnosis. Then I'll provide some practical solutions to address the workplace challenges and some how-tos in creating a sort of a game plan to continue working. So let's get started. Now, in the past, as recent as the 70s, even though it was like 30, 40 years ago, cancer was still considered a very private affair. There was a stigma or a shame associated with it. And in some cultural groups and in some countries, there is still that stigma or shame associated with it. And fortunately, we've seen quite a few changes in our society. But in the workplace, there's still some fears and concerns, as what was brought up previously, that one's productivity may be affected, or there's going to be concerns about how to communicate with one who has been diagnosed with cancer. And it even brings a sense of vulnerability to our coworkers and others around us, because it reminds us all that we are vulnerable, since cancer can strike anyone. Again, however, with the dramatic increase in cancer survivors, we're seeing that number grow wonderfully by the years, and the changing attitudes, employees are getting more support from their employers in terms of better benefits and some programs such as providing cancer support groups in the workplace. Nonetheless, it's difficult to find the right words or timing when it comes to telling others about your diagnosis. So how to begin? Well, first, it would be wise to prepare that game plan. That is a plan that will outline the things that you will need to receive support in from your workplace. For example, how soon will your treatment begin? Will it have an impact on you? Will you need to ask for medical leave? So, and all those other questions, and Deborah did a wonderful job of pointing out some of the details of that. So after you speak with your oncologist and you get more details about the treatment plan and everything, take a few moments, find a little corner for yourself, get a drink of water, a nice cup of tea, get a pen, a pencil, and a pad, take a deep breath, and then just begin writing. So you can begin with what the doctor told you, what your oncologist told you. Jot down when your treatment will begin and how much time you were told that you would need. Make notes regarding when you believe you'll be able to get back to work or, what you were told. And again, remember, this is dynamic. The plan is fluid, so it's not set in stone. And ask yourself these questions and jot down your answers to them. Will you need transition time? For example, will you need to work part-time? Or will you use telecommunicating time or flex time? And will it be immediately after your treatment? Or will it be for an extended period of time after your treatment? Identify someone that you could identify as your backup person to actually cover your assignments. And sometimes, if you're really good, it may be a whole team of people who are going to need to cover all of your assignments. The other thing you might want to do is identify a group of fellow employees that can help with parts of your responsibilities, especially when you're in the midst of a critical project or numerous deadlines. So that's a whole team approach that you're using there, and that's always very helpful. Also appoint someone who can be your go-to person. That is, pick one person who serves as the go-between you and your office colleagues and your manager or supervisor. That way, if you only have one person, it will help minimize the number of calls needed between you and your office, and you'll be able to have the time you need to get better and to heal yourself and be ready to go back to work. Prepare a schedule for yourself of how to keep in touch. Is it going to be through calls, through emails? Are they going to be weekly? Are they going to be twice a week? Are they going to need to be more if you're in the middle of a critical project? You may even wish to develop a little contact form that you can email to folks where you can kind of keep them updated on projects. And when possible, have some time in the office if you can do that, just to let coworkers know that you are present. And as Dr. Fleischman pointed out, it's good to meet with the advanced practice nurse or the social worker and go over your workday. I thought that was an excellent idea because it's also a good time to also plan for any kind of medication-related side effects that may come up, like your nausea or your vomiting or your fatigue. Is there a place, perhaps, that they can set up a cot that you can go and rest for a couple of moments or a couch or just a place where you can just even maybe sit quietly so you can get your energy back? Next, remind yourself, and don't even just remind yourself, be sure and promise yourself that you're going to get as much information as you can from your human resource department. Find out who your HR representative is. Ask about family medical leaves or all those policies that Deborah spoke about that may exist regarding employees diagnosed with cancer. It's also very, very critical to get information on your legal rights, just as what was explained to us earlier. And you can begin asking yourself, who do you need to tell? It's always good to keep your supervisor or manager in the loop of communication. You want to have their support as much as possible during your cancer journey. But is it necessary to tell other colleagues in your workplace, or can it be on a need-to-know basis? Just one word of caution, and Deborah spoke briefly about this. Be sure to be aware of your corporate culture and make adjustments as needed. For instance, one patient shared that her management asked her not to share her diagnosis with her customers for fear that they would think she would not be able to meet deadlines and requests. In another organization, competition may be extremely aggressive, and information such as a cancer diagnosis may be used against the person. Fortunately, though, the majority of corporate cultures are quite the opposite of these scenarios, especially at this time in our society. So as you prepare to tell, you want to continue jotting down the type of information that you'd want to share. And these might be some of the points that you'd want to share with your supervisor, but not necessarily with all of your colleagues. For instance, you may wish to disclose your diagnosis, what that diagnosis means. And if you got any information about your prognosis, you might want to share that. Your expected treatment plan, the expected leave of absences, the name of your oncologist or other members of your team. Also be prepared with documentation regarding your diagnosis or any other information that may be helpful to your supervisor or manager. There are also resources available to help your manager better understand your situations. For example, there's a website called cancerandcareers.org that has a manager's kit that you could download and give to your manager to kind of use as a resource as you're going through your meeting. And again, as Deborah pointed out, it would really be good to get an understanding of what are your basic functions. That way you have a clear understanding of the expectations and your supervisor has a reminder of what they told you, what those expectations were. So who to tell? It's a decision that you will need to make. It can depend on how much you value your privacy, what type of relationships you may have with your coworkers, or any other reservations you may have, such as the fear that your career will suffer if you do tell others. If you are close to your coworkers, you may wish to talk a bit about your feelings, such as your current attitude toward your diagnosis, some of your hopes, some of your fears, and some of your plans. Also, be prepared for all kinds of reactions from your colleagues. Some may show fear, discomfort, some even pity, but then on the other hand, you'll have many that will show you support, understanding, and sympathy. When you do decide to share, whether it be with your colleagues or your supervisor, find a quiet spot where both of you can, or all of you can have some time. Share what you wish to share and just be open and honest. And it's okay if you feel a bit nervous or anxious. This is a big disclosure that you're making. Just remember, it is your choice on how much you wish to share and with whom you wish to share. There is no doubt, though, that despite the wonderful advances made in curing cancer, cancer is still an uncomfortable topic to talk about, no matter how positive a person is or how good the prognosis. The good news is that having your plan lets your manager and coworkers know that you value your commitment to your job and to your fellow workers. It also gives a message that you are being proactive, reassuring them not to worry, and reminding them that you'll be back. Once you have your plan, you will feel more comfortable in communicating with your diagnosis with your supervisor or manager or coworkers. So it's time. You can make an appointment with your supervisor, go in with your plan, and information obtained from your HR representative. Oh, yes, once your meeting is over, be sure and make notes about your meeting, the outcomes negotiated, positive statements made, or even not-so-positive statements made that may have been indicative of discrimination. So now you're prepared, ready, set, game on. By the way, I'm sure many of you listening on this call have some valuable tips to share, and hopefully you will do so in our Q&A. Thank you, and that concludes my remarks.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Palos, for a wonderful presentation, and also for a wonderful recommendation that during the Q&A, if some of you have some tips that have worked, we will remind you that we would love to hear your tips as well, and you can ask questions, but you also could share tips of things that have worked for you. That would be wonderful. And our next speaker is Sarah Kelly. Sarah is an oncology social worker at Cancer Care, and Sarah is going to discuss with you the free psychosocial support services offered by Cancer Care and the important role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Kelly.
Thank you, Carolyn, and I also want to thank everyone else on the call. We got so much good information today. As Carolyn said, I'm an oncology social worker at Cancer Care, and I work with many people coping with cancer as well as their loved ones. And I really want to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer. And I want to talk about how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are a lot of ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling. Those are provided face-to-face in the New York area and then over the telephone nationally. We also provide support groups, which are face-to-face in the New York area, over the telephone, and also online nationally. We have education about resources, how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and also some limited financial assistance, as well as chemotherapy copay assistance. All our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends and loved ones. They're also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, which definitely, you know, so includes what we talked about today, psychological impact and care. You know, I think adjusting to and dealing with a diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. You know, as you know, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family and support network. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. You know, I really want to stress that. You don't have to do this by yourself. You don't have to walk the path alone. You know, if you join a support group, you're really connecting with others who are going through a similar situation or having similar problems. With individual counseling, you have a space that's just yours to voice any concerns you may have. I think the connections help lessen the isolation that many people who are affected by cancer experience. I think if you're feeling well emotionally, it really helps you better deal with the diagnosis and treatment. If you're interested in any of Cancer Care services, please call our Hope line. It's 1-800-813-HOPE, so 1-800-813-4673. You can also visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And our website is very comprehensive. There's a lot of additional information on your diagnosis and treatment and coping. There's just a lot on there, so I definitely recommend you take a look there, too. And as we learned from today's program, you know, there's a lot of information, and a lot of information certainly to digest and get your arms around. Our social workers can help you understand what it means for you and your loved ones. You know, really, the social worker can help you prioritize. And if you need to, let's say, you know, figure out what you want to talk to the medical team about, your employer about, all of these things to get, you know, answers and information you need, we can help you with that. Really, I just want you to remember you're not alone in this. You know, Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk today.
Oh, thank you very much, Sarah. Wonderful presentation and wonderful tips for everybody as well. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions. And I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board and also to actually explain to the audience how to queue up to either ask a question or to make a comment about something that they did, a helpful tip to others who are facing cancer in the workplace. So, Stephanie, if you could explain to the audience how to queue up, and we'll take comments or questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, comment, or a tip, you may press the star 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Our first question comes from Bill H. Your line is open.
Yeah, this is Bill. I want to ask you, when I was diagnosed, I went through all the process, and when I got out of the treatment, I was told by my company after being on short-term disability that I had to apply for Social Security disability. So I had to go through that or I would not get long-term. So I went through that. I got long-term, and after I got long-term, I was going to get rid of my insurance from my company. Well, Medicare told me to keep it, and I did. Anyway, 3 years ago, I got a letter from them telling me that I could not have them and Medicare D. And I was depressed and everything because that helped me to pay my health insurance. But anyway, I found a letter from them saying that if I get Medicare D, then I don't have to. I can keep what they gave me, my health care from them. And so I sent them that letter, and I never heard back from them. And what I'm saying is I'm still worried that they would try to come back with some type of letter telling me that I have to get rid of them again, and I don't want to go through that again. Is there anybody I can talk to or find out how I can protect myself? Because I had called them 2 months ago, and I never got a return back from them, and it was during when they were going through the walk, and it was a bomb blew up, and they haven't called me back. But then I also called them after that, and I have not heard from them.
Well, Billy, thank you. First of all, it's nice to have you on the call again. It's good to have your question. And what we're going to do is we're going to see if Deborah Wolf can address a part of your question. She may not have all the details that she needs, but she's going to address a part of your question. And then why don't you and I talk after the call, because we certainly don't want you to have to be living with concerns about something that you've done and worried about that. So, Deborah, can you address this in terms of just generally this issue?
Sure. I mean, the rules are very complicated, so I'll give just a very broad overview. And when somebody is on long-term disability through their job, they generally are also required to apply for Social Security disability because there's what they call a coordination of benefits. So that's very common that you have to apply for Social Security. And then once you've been on Social Security disability for 2 years or if you turn 65, you become eligible for Medicare. And the rules regarding private insurance and Medicare are probably too complicated to go into detail here, but while somebody's working, if they have both, their private insurance is primary and then Medicare is considered secondary. If somebody stops working, even if they have both, it reverses, and Medicare usually is primary and any private insurance, including Part D for prescription coverage, is secondary. There are some variations, but that's generally how it works, although generally a person can have Medicare and private insurance. But every policy is different. Your insurance policy is a contract, and if it says, you know, once you become eligible for Medicare, we're not going to cover you anymore, that can be binding. But again, it's a very complicated law, but that's generally how it works in terms of Medicare being primary once somebody stops working.
And does this happen frequently, Deborah, that someone does get a letter from the employer with these details? Is that something that happens very often for people?
Well, one of the things that I always urge everyone to do is if your employer is required to give you a summary plan description of your benefits, and it should have not only information about the benefits that you have, but what the requirements are and what might be required of you. So sometimes planning ahead is good so that you understand exactly what's coming down the trail in terms of you know, benefits, including disability, including insurance coverage, because every employer is different. so it's good to know in advance exactly what to expect. But that is very common.
Okay, thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants. I think it's actually for you, Deborah. Can you use the FMLA 12 weeks every year or one time only?
It's every 12 months, but it's up to the employer to determine how they want to measure that 12 months. Some employers will do it on a January to December period so that every year you get 12 weeks. Most employers will start the clock ticking from the time that you first request FMLA protection. So if, let's say, on June 1st, you start FMLA leave, then your year is going to be June 1st through the following end of May. And most employers choose that option, but it is 12 weeks every 12 months. So it is a continuing benefit that you have.
Excellent. Okay, and there's another question actually from one of our online participants as well. And so it's a question about someone who has had cancer in the past and is trying to get a new job or new insurance coverage. Are there any protections for us or pitfalls to look out for? Deborah Wolf, could you address that question?
Protections or pitfalls relating to insurance coverage, Carolyn?
It looks like it's both. Are there any protections for us or pitfalls to look out for in terms of both getting a new job with a cancer history or also in terms of new insurance coverage? It looks like it's both.
Yes. So with respect to getting a new job, I mean, the ADA certainly offers protections in that it prohibits an employer from asking any questions of a medical nature during an interview. So while somebody is looking for a job and interviewing for a job, an employer can't have a questionnaire that asks about a medical history or ask any medical questions. So that certainly offers protections while somebody is looking for a job. It should be based on your work experience and whether or not you're the right person for the job and not on what your medical history is or whether or not you've had a cancer diagnosis. With respect to health insurance, in 2014, the Affordable Care Act will now prohibit any pre-existing condition exclusions, so that's something to look forward to next year. Right now, there's another law called HIPAA. Some of you might be familiar with respect to its privacy requirements, but HIPAA also requires that if somebody has insurance and they're changing jobs or they switch insurance, and there's no more than a 63-day gap in coverage, that even if that new policy says we won't cover pre-existing conditions, it's null and void. So under HIPAA, if you move from one policy to a new policy without a gap in coverage of more than 63 days, your new policy has to cover you for any pre-existing condition.
Another question for you, actually, really from one of our online participants. So how long do you need to be employed before you are eligible for FMLA and just all the qualifications for FMLA criteria, if you could just go over that again as well?
FMLA, you have to have worked at your job for 1 year. You have to have worked at least 1,250 hours, and it has to be an employer with 50 or more employees. If you don't meet that criteria, as I mentioned, some people can ask for time off as an ADA reasonable accommodation. But generally for FMLA, the criteria is 1 year, 50 or more employees.
Okay. And this is a question that I think I'd like Deborah to start with it, but I also would like Stu and Sarah to comment it as well. So this question is really having to do with all great suggestions. What happens when you are the HR person and have fears of sharing issues about diagnosis and treatment for concerns about being passed over for positions you know you are going to be available to advance one's career? So the issue of having disclosure and the concern that it might impact career advances. Deborah, would you start with that one, and then I'll have Stu and also Sarah comment as well.
Well, I mean, you know, as I mentioned, I mean, the law really prohibits taking that into consideration. As long as somebody can do the essential functions of their job, they should be considered in the same manner as everyone else. But, of course, we know that that doesn't always happen. Again, with respect to disclosure, I think it's I mean, I believe that people should only disclose when they have to, and that would include, you know, taking a medical leave or requesting an accommodation. Other than that, I don't see any reason to disclose in the workplace. I don't know if Dr. Fleischman or Dr. Palos has other thoughts.
Dr. Fleischman, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I agree. I have seen over my career a number of times when people were concerned about what to disclose. They were fearful of being discriminated against because they had a history of having been treated for cancer, even though they're fine, fear that they would be absent a lot, or if they got a recurrence or a relapse, they would be absent for an extended period of time, or they wouldn't be able to function on the job as well as they could be expected. I don't know how many of these actually wind up in front of an attorney. Sometimes I think it's rather subtle, but I think the smartest thing to do is disclose only what's necessary when necessary, and you're not obligated to disclose, I guess, unless you're asked.
And actually, Deborah, what about, you really can't be asked, can you, in terms of disclosure? Is that correct with ADA?
That you can't be asked?
Yes.
Yes, I mean, during the interview, the ADA has three tiers. So during the interview process, there should be no questions about medical history. If somebody is offered a job, that can be a conditional job offer. But the criteria is it has to be conditions that are imposed on everybody that's being hired for this level or this position. And during this Tier 2, an employer can ask medical questions. It doesn't even have to be related to the job. They can have medical questionnaires. But the important thing to remember is that even if somebody is forced to disclose, it can't, the employer can't use that to renege on the job offer unless they can show that the person wouldn't be able to do the essential functions of their job. And then while somebody has a job, an employer can only make inquiry if it's consistent with business necessity, if there's an actual business reason why they need to know this information. And usually, as I mentioned, that's for jobs with an element of public safety. But during the initial job interview, no questions can be asked, and very rarely are conditional, are job offers conditional and based on medical information.
Excellent. And Sarah, do you want to comment on just the role of support groups and help for people?
Yeah, you know, I think that with this, first of all, I just want to say that this information is so incredibly important. This is something that comes up all the time, and I think a lot of the times, you know, maybe patients, caregivers are not always aware of what the protections are and when to disclose. And, you know, I think that with an oncology social worker or in a support group, that this is something that you can talk about. Of course, in a support group, you can hear how other people are coping with that. And I also think with the individual counseling, that really is a space for you to work with the social worker to help organize and prioritize some of this and to get some of this information.
And actually, Deborah, if you could comment, there is a question from one of our online participants. When is cancer a disability under the ADA?
Well, under the new Americans with Disabilities Amendment Act, I think under most, under all circumstances, cancer is going to be considered a disability. I mean, as I mentioned, it has to impair a major life activity, but the definition of what is a major life activity is very broad and can include working, can include walking, sleeping. So the with the new law, the definition of what is a disability is very broad, and that would include illnesses such as cancer that do go into remission. Even at that point, a person is covered.
And we do have another question from one of our online participants, which I know we've addressed, but it sounds like this may be still a question in people's minds. May an employer ask a job applicant whether he has or had cancer or about treatment related to cancer prior to making a job offer?
Prior to making a job offer, the answer is no.
Okay. Excellent. And then there is another question about just from one of our online participants, can you provide tips to manage the new normal with cancer while balancing my work, life, and career? And Dr. Fleischman, can you address that question?
Well, I think one of the things that people always talk about is expecting the unexpected, and that things are different, but you don't know how it's going to be until it actually happens to you. So try to be sort of open to feeling different at work, really focused on getting the work done properly and less about the disclosure to others. And then I think most people find their place. In my experience, most patients, after a long period of time, sometimes a long period of time, actually wind up telling colleagues about their cancer, and many times their colleagues suspected something was wrong, but they were being very respectful of someone's privacy or didn't want to say. And after a period of time, these things usually sort of get settled, and people are comfortable discussing it. But that's the kind of discomfort that happens in the workplace, and it often just takes a lot of time for people to really get comfortable in either addressing it or having colleagues actually broach the topic.
Thank you. And Sarah, again, can you comment on just the role of support groups or individual support in managing this new normal?
Yeah, I loved what Dr. Fleischman said about expecting the unexpected, because I think there is so much of that in there, and you really don't know what's going to happen until it happens, until you're in it. I think what support groups, what individual counseling can do is give you a place to learn how to cope with all of those changes, how to cope with the unexpected until you find your grounding again. It really, is an adjustment. And it takes some time, but I think that with an oncology social worker, with other supports there to help you, it just, you're going to get there maybe a little bit faster than if you don't have those things and you have that added support of it.
Excellent. Thank you. Well, this is, I have to say, this has been an extraordinary call. I actually want to thank all of our speakers and all of you who've queued up and really asked such wonderful questions online. They've really enhanced our call today. I want to remind all of you that this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we know that you have many needs that go far beyond a one-hour program. So with that in mind, I do want to remind all of you that although the workshop will soon end, the services that you can access from Cancer Care, those go on really endlessly. And we have a staff of many oncology social workers who provide counseling and support, just someone to talk to. We also have telephone and online support groups, and we also offer practical and financial assistance, as well as these workshops. And also, we also offer many publications and fact sheets. And we have a very robust website with lots of information on it as well. Most importantly, as we're about to conclude the program, I don't want anyone to feel you're alone in coping with cancer in the workplace or in coping with cancer in general. We want you to know that you're part of this community of support, and we're simply a telephone call away at 1-800-813-4673, or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.